something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with part two of our talk about halos and the nimbus and the aureole, the glory that glows behind the figure, whether that's a Christian saint or Huwawa the Terrible, or did we end up last week actually talking about luchadors at all?
I think we did, very briefly, partially because we were in the process of putting together a Weird House Cinema episode on an El Santo film. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the question came up. Are there any halos used with luchador designs, with the idea being that, yeah, there are a number of different Catholicism-themed luchadors. So after we recorded, I did look into it a little bit. I looked at some of the usual suspects and looked on Lucha Wiki and looked at some photos. I didn't notice any halo motifs in the mask for the most part, like nothing like actually physically emerging and positioned above the head. Mm-hmm. You know, you see a lot of crosses, et cetera. The best example I did find, though, was a luchador named Angel Azul, one of at least four different luchadors who's used that name. And this particular mask depicts an entire angel, like a Christmas topper angel on the front of the mask, and that angel has a halo. So it's positioned so that the angel's head and halo appear more or less in the center of the forehead.
So I assume this is a Technico, not a Rudo.
I guess so. I don't know anything about this guy, but it looks like a Technico mask. You know, if you have an angel like that, you know, it's got to be. But then again, he could easily turn Rudo and become a fallen angel, especially if he loses that mask.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a bad angel can be really bad. You get angels of death. I remember a particularly haunting Miklos Radnoti poem called The Terrifying Angel, where he mm-hmm. an angel appears to him and advises him to remove his own skin.
Yeah. There are a number of different, in Lucha, there have been a few different angels of death, Angel de la Muerte. There's one I remember seeing on TV that did not really have any kind of angelic themes in his outfit. But I did run across on Lucha Wiki an old photo from a magazine that had showed a guy with a halo motif, again, on the forehead, almost like a third eye. But that's the only thing I could really find in terms of dudes like this with halos. Now, another thing that comes to mind, though, you know, we were talking a little bit about halos and angels and certainly in art, but I started thinking more and more about films. And I can't think of a single example of an angelic being presented in, say, a horror film or some sort of supernatural film in which they have a halo. Like, I was thinking, like, what are some of the angel visitation scenes that come to mind? And I thought of, well, I thought of Bill Paxton's film Frailty, which has a great angel visitation scene, like a a hallucination that emerges in his mind. But there's no halo.
Now, I might be remembering that wrong. I thought that the angel in that, it doesn't have like a ring halo around the head or anything specifically concentrated on the head, but I did recall a kind of like full body glow. Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, it definitely has a glow to it. And there's a lot of like heavenly architecture going on above it. Mm-hmm. But in terms of something more instantly recognizable as a halo, not so much. Likewise, I was thinking back to the prophecy films with Christopher Walken. A lot of angels in that, a lot of angel wings, and you can think of various things that were clearly influenced by that. You know, we have angels and fallen angels popping up, and filmmakers will go nuts giving them big feathery wings, but I don't think they ever really include the halo, and it's kind of interesting because I guess it comes down to the fact that it's easy to think of it as such a cliche thing. But at the same time, it is so weird, and there's so many ways to depict it. You'd think you would see more of it. I don't know. I'd love to hear from folks out there who have encountered really cool halos in genre pictures, because I'd love to see it.
Now, in the last episode, did you bring up the idea of a Cenobite from like the Clive Barker verse with a halo?
I can't remember if we did, but I started looking into it after the podcast. And I think there's in a comic, Hellraiser comic book, there's a Cenobite named Halo, but he doesn't really have a halo. Now, there was a Clive Barker action figure for the Todd McFarlane toys for the Tortured Souls line. And this guy, this particular guy, Agonistes, has kind of a surgical halo around his head, like a halo. And then he also has what I think is like a human face, maybe his own human face positioned behind him, that also seems to mimic halo iconography. So it's a very Cenobite-esque character. So this seems to come close. You know, certainly Clive Barker loves toying around with religious imagery. So it makes sense that we would find an example of this in something he designed.
Yeah.
Fun fact, those figures that came out, turns out they each had a portion of a novella in them that I think for a long time you could only get if you bought all the figures, but it's subsequently been put out sometime in the last 5 years or so, titled Tortured Souls, The Legend of Primordium. And I read it over the weekend, enjoying some time out in the hammock, and it was pretty fun. You know, it's like there's not a relatable human character in the whole thing. It's just like a bunch of like sort of monsters and so forth. It's in a like kind of a dark fantasy setting, kind of Hellraiser-y at times for sure, but not entirely. Like it was really good. It was one of the, I haven't read a lot of Clive Barker recently, but this one is new to me and I enjoyed it.
So a novella that comes serially within the action figures that you would buy at Spencer's Gifts in the 90s.
Yeah, and and to my shock, it was actually really enjoyable. So there you go.
I wonder if the Insane Clown Posse action figures had a novella that came with them.
I doubt it. I think this was the only. I think there was actually another Clive Barker line where it was some sort of like carnival kind of a theme where he did another one. Like this, where he had different chapters in a novella that all came together if you bought all the figures, but that one is also available to read now, but I haven't read it. It's interesting though with the action figures though, because the whole thing, right, is that you don't take them out of the box if you're collecting them. If that was the case, you wouldn't get to read the cool little novella chapters that are hidden within there.
Well, you wouldn't get to play with them either. I mean, what are you supposed to do with these things?
I don't know. They don't look tremendously fun to play with. They're very grisly.
Have a little tea party with your Barbie and your Cenobites.
Yeah, but like I say, the novella was fun.
So in the last episode, we ended up talking about a lot of the different ways that the halo or the nimbus has been represented or characterized in history. You know, sometimes as a glowing disk behind the head or even a solid looking kind of gold disk, sometimes even as a square or as a ring around the head, other times as a kind of just general emanation of light, like a glow coming from behind the head, almost as if there's bioluminescent hair or a light bulb behind the head or behind the whole body. A full body glow is sometimes characterized as a halo or aureole or nimbus. And when it comes to the kind that's just like a glow or an emanation of divine light from around the body, I started to wonder about the idea of the aura. Now, I guess there's a general concept of an aura that you could just think of as like this is any emanation of color or light from a body, like in the ancient Mesopotamian mythology where we talked about Humbaba or Huwawa having the seven terrors or the radiance, the terrifying radiance that emanated from his body. Those things could be viewed as an aura. But there's also a more specific definition of an aura, which is a sort of standard claim in the modern world of psychics and New Age spirituality and parapsychology. People often claim to be able to see some kind of aura around human bodies and sometimes around other objects. So I wonder, could this modern belief in auras in any way be related to the origins of the religious belief in the halo, the glory, the melam, the sun disk crown, etc.?
And this sounds perfectly reasonable, right? I mean, this is, a lot of it is getting, it would seem on the surface at least, to get to the same ideas, the idea that there's something either emanating out of you or through you, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. And the secondary question, if people do really sometimes see a glow of color or a cloud of blazing light around someone, what would cause that? So I want to transition to this subject for a bit and look at it a few different ways. The first thing I wanted to know was, wait a second, is it actually possible in just a straightforward scientific physical sense that humans do actually sometimes glow? Yeah, I don't know. I've come across weirder facts on this show before, so I started looking into this. The first thing I thought of was, I wonder if there's ever been a case where somebody was made to glow by exposure to, I don't know, something in the environment. And the thing that popped to my mind was in The Simpsons, when characters who work at the nuclear power plant acquire what Mr. Burns would call a healthy green glow. So I was wondering, does exposure to radiation actually have the potential to make people glow? Unfortunately, it seems the answer is no. Ionizing radiation is generally invisible itself, and being exposed to it can, of course, wreck your body, but it won't make you glow. This myth actually probably comes from a combination of facts, the first of which would be about radioluminescence. So there are some materials that do glow in the presence of ionizing radiation. For example, the paint that was once commonly used for radium dials on clock faces and is sometimes still used for like instruments that are made to be viewed in the dark, for example, in spacecraft. You know, so you want a dial or an instrument that'll glow in the dark without having to have any kind of power supply to it or or an LED inside it or anything like that. This radioluminescent paint actually had to have a combination of two major elements in order to make it glow. In the old school kind that was used by like the company Undark, or you know, that was tragically the cause of the death and sickening of the Radium Girls. This was a paint that was made with radium, which is the radioactive element that supplied the ionizing radiation. But then it also had to have an element that is known as a phosphor, which is a chemical that glows when it's stimulated by alpha and beta particles and gamma rays from the radioactive element. And in the case of the radioluminescent paint that was used by Undark and companies like that in the first half of the 20th century, the phosphor was usually zinc sulfide that was then laced with a metal like copper to give it a green color. And so because of the specific nature of this material, this phosphor, when the atoms in it are struck by ionizing radiation, they get excited, their electrons jump up to a higher energy level, and then they fall back down to their ground state. And when they fall back down to their ground state, they emit a photon of light as they do that. They release the energy back out. And this is the glow we see. And of course, the color of the glow can be determined by what kind of metal it's laced with. Again, copper tends to give a green color. So I think this is the source of the belief that radiation will cause something to have a green glow. It won't cause anything to have a green glow. It will specifically give a green glow to paint with a phosphor in it and something to make that glow the color green, like copper.
Okay.
So long story short, exposure to ionizing radiation can absolutely kill you, but it will not make you glow, I guess, unless you coat yourself in a phosphor.
Okay, so that one episode of The Simpsons where Mr. Burns has been found to be wandering through the right. woods after his medical treatments.
Yeah. No. Unless maybe he somehow paints his body in zinc sulfide or something, zinc sulfide and copper, and then just gets some plutonium in there, maybe.
Okay.
I don't know how long he would survive that, though.
Well, as I think was explained on the show, Mr. Burns is in peril from so many different causes of death that they're stuck in the door, right?
Right. Like Three Stooges syndrome.
Yeah.
So even the ionizing radiation is going, whoa, 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 whoa. So anyway, you're not going to have a situation where, I don't know, a person in the ancient world came across a stash of uranium ore and then somehow ended up glowing green. So everybody would see him and think, wow, you know, that guy's a god or something. Okay. That just wouldn't happen. But I came across another fact that is pretty weird, which is that in a qualified sense, the human body actually does just naturally glow. Meaning it doesn't only reflect light from external sources, but the body actually does emit electromagnetic radiation in the visible spectrum. Visible light comes out of your body.
Huh.
But before you get too excited, the amount of light that our bodies put out on average is really, really tiny. It's roughly 1,000 times too dim to see with the naked eye. You need special scientific instruments in a very dark room to pick it up. But you should know that this is different from like the heat that we emit as infrared radiation. If this light were bright enough, it would be light that would actually have a color that you could see with your eyes. It is that kind of light. And of course, it's not just us. Most or maybe all other animals would also emit a similar kind of light. Nevertheless, this glow is kind of interesting. I was wondering, so what makes this glow happen? It appears to be chemical reactions involving free radicals within the body. There was a 2009 study that tried to measure this photon emission from the human body using special equipment. So this was by Masaki Kobayashi, Daisuke Kikuchi, and Hitoshi Okamura, published in PLOS-1 in 2009, called Imaging of Ultra-Weak Spontaneous Photon Emission from Human Body Displaying Diurnal Rhythm. And so what the researchers did here was they used a cryogenic CCD camera to image 5 healthy male subjects in their 20s at different times throughout the day. So the subjects would come in, they'd sit in a chair. I think they were partially naked or at least bare-chested in the chair in a dark room for at least 20 minutes. I think there was a period of adjustment to the darkness. And then after that, they'd be photographed for 20 minutes with the special camera. And they do this every day for every 3 hours from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. And the researchers actually found that the amount of light emitted from the body varied significantly over the day. So people glowed the most at about 4 p.m. and the least at 10 a.m. And they hypothesized that this probably has something to do with how energy metabolism changes throughout the day, according to our circadian rhythms. But also interesting, or at least I thought this was interesting, Rob, I've attached a picture for you to look at down here. The body did not glow equally everywhere. In fact, faces tended to glow more than the rest of the body. It seems like, and there were other kinds of differences, like upper shoulders seemed to glow a little bit more than down lower around like the chest or the stomach. And different parts of the face glowed more than other parts. So it looks like the area around the mouth in particular was usually glowing more than, say, like the forehead or around the eyes or the sides of the face. This thing about the mouth especially makes me imagine an alternate history of halo imagery where the glow is not just surrounding the crown of the head, but emanating from the mouth and jaw, a kind of glory beard.
Oh, okay. Also kind of a Lopan effect, right?
Ooh, yes.
Like when we first encounter Lopan and he has light coming out of his eyes and then out of his mouth.
One of my favorite line deliveries there is the incredulous way that Kurt Russell says that he had light coming out of his mouth.
Yes. Big Trouble in Little China, for anyone who's not familiar.
But anyway, so I was reading an NBC News report about this study from 2009 by Charles Q. Choi, and he wrote that one reason that the face might glow more than the rest of the body is that usually faces are more tanned than the rest of the body since they get more exposure to sunlight, and that he said that the pigment behind that tanning in the skin, melanin, has fluorescent compounds that might help the skin produce even more light than other skin on the body does.
Okay.
But since this glow is not detectable with the naked eye, none of this is going to have anything to do with the origins of halo or nimbus or aureole imagery, though it is a nice thing to know nonetheless.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting Mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get Mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for Mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for Mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday,
You can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
But to come back to the place we started, people do, of course, sometimes make various paranormal claims that they can see a glow of colored light emanating from human beings. Again, this is sometimes called like an aura or an energy field. I have to be kind of circumspect here. The belief in auras is, I have discovered, an exceedingly complicated subject with a weird and interesting history. Maybe one we'll have to come back to and explore more in the future, since this is one of those subjects. I'm sure you've had this experience on the show before, Rob, where like I was trying to read into it so I could give a brief overview, but it was kind of like you go down into a basement and you open an old chest to just like get the things out and see what's inside it. But then something in there starts moving. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay. So I cannot get my brain fully around this subject. I think I can only mention some aspects of it. From what I can tell, the New Age belief in seeing auras seems to stem from a kind of reinterpretation of the medieval tantric belief in chakras. So chakras would have been a belief original to esoteric Hindu. It's kind of hard to succinctly describe even what these are, but I think you can think of them as sort of a collection of nodes or channels that are positioned at different points inside the body and correspond to elements of an imagined subtle body, a second non-material energy-based body, and the images of these channels or nodes throughout the body would be used in some kinds of tantric meditation. So you might focus mental imagery on one of these nodes at various points positioned, often along a sort of vertical axis through the middle of the body, but also at a few other points. So, Rob, I think you probably know more about this world. Is that basically your understanding?
Yeah, I think that's a good basic summary of it. And I've engaged in yoga and meditation that uses chakras as well. I guess one way that I like to think of it is, it is not the way the body actually works, but it is a way that the body can be interpreted to aid in meditation or yoga, like thinking about like this energy point moving from chakra to chakra, focusing on say breathing through your third eye. You know, obviously you're not really breathing through a hole in your skull. Mm-hmm. But somehow like focusing on that can be very helpful. It gives you like a different physical focus to get out of your thoughts and even sort of focus on the physicality of that part of your body. I find it very helpful. Though again, I do not engage with it in a way where I think of this as like the actual way that the energy in my body is working.
Right. It might not correspond to like physical anatomical realities, but can serve as a focal point for mental imagery and a way of directing the thoughts. Yeah. But so that's chakras, I think, like within the esoteric Hindu tradition. Then in the late 19th and early 20th century, it seems this idea somehow got sort of picked up and reinterpreted by various people associated with new religious movements like theosophy. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the 20th century New Age belief in auras as an emanation from the body seems to trace back to a British spiritualist and theosophist writer named Charles Webster Ledbetter, who lived from 1854 to 1934. I can only give the briefest glance into this world because it seems very, it's like looking at Gnosticism or something. It's just like, you cannot really understand it from the outside, but I was trying to peek in and get some kind of characterization here. So I found a couple of quotes from a writing by Ledbetter called, this was a book called Man Visible and Invisible. I think this was actually a reproduction of an earlier pamphlet or essay he had done about the belief in auras. And he writes the following: "All members of our society will be familiar with the idea that every human being is surrounded by a sort of luminous cloud, which we have agreed to call the aura, and we have heard from those who have succeeded in developing the special sense by which it is cognized that it has various beautiful colors, and that from a study of it, much may be learnt as to the disposition, the thoughts, and even the past life of its possessor." And then later he comes to a physical description of what this aura is, what it looks like. He writes, We find that it is exceedingly complex in structure. At the first glance, it is seen as a luminous cloud extending to a distance of about 18 inches or 2 feet from the body in all directions, and therefore approximately oval in shape, whence it is sometimes spoken of in occult writings as the auric egg. In most cases, it has no well-defined outline, but its edges fade into invisibility very gradually. And I think this is interesting because this really does sound like he's describing the halo glow that we see in a lot of religious artwork or hear described in a lot of religious poetry, a sort of oval shaped framing or emanation of light from the body that sort of gradually dissipates as it gets farther away.
Yeah. It also kind of feels like my holy personal space that
yes.
thou shalt not intrude upon.
Right. Don't put anything in my auric egg. And then he goes on to explain a bunch more stuff, like that these are actually composed of a number of layers of underlying auras, one that he calls the health aura, which there's one that has something to do with the Hindu concept of prana or life force. There's one that has something to do with desire. And the ability to see these alleged auras in this context is usually ascribed to people either with special powers of sight, some kind of psychic perception, or even more often, it seems, with special training, who have worked to harness their ability to see the auras of others. Now, as with many other psychic and paranormal phenomena, people who claim to be able to see auras as an objective physical phenomenon have repeatedly been put to the test in parapsychology research, which, from what I read, usually finds no evidence for any consistency in the perception of auras. It seems to me like it is more likely an internal, subjective, interpreted experience, not a perception of an objectively verifiable external reality. And these tests can include lots of different things. Like some of them, you might look at the auras of different people who are obscured by a screen and then later try to identify the same people again when the screen is removed. Okay, so you saw their auras, which person was standing where behind the screen. And usually people who claim to have aura perception abilities cannot perform better than chance at this. Nevertheless, there does seem to be a real perception of the ability to view a glow emanating from people. And so that does make you wonder, like, okay, well, even if this is not an externally verifiable physical reality, people are for some reason believing that they see something. They look at somebody and they think they see a luminous cloud surrounding them. So could that have anything to do with the halo or nimbus tradition? One interesting coincidence, this might just be a total coincidence, actually, not have any causal link. But one interesting thing I come across while I was poking around at aura perception on the internet is that there is often a belief that there are 7 layers of auras. There are actually different systems where people say there are different numbers of layers, but a common one is 7 layers, which takes me back to the ancient Mesopotamian ogre Huwawa or Humbaba, who is said to have 7 terrors or 7 auras that he could take off one at a time.
Oh, no, that is a very good point. Yeah. I wonder if there's an actual connection there or, because I mean, we also have to think again back to the chakra tradition in which there, you know, you're generally dealing with the 7 chakra system. So that might be the way it's connected as well.
Right. But I think it's also worth noting that there are some major differences, as far as I can see, between how these different religious concepts like the halo versus the aura are described. For example, in New Age mysticism, the aura is usually said to emanate from every living being. Again, I think there's probably some variation there, but it's a common claim that like even insects and plants and even sometimes inanimate objects would have their own aura. Whereas the halo, both in Christian iconography and in its predecessors from ancient religion, this would be reserved for special beings. It's the divine spotlight, like you said last time, or it's the emanation of terrifying God power.
I mean, it does make me think about just the idea of beholding somebody and that person being, say, particularly beautiful or charismatic, you know, and, you know, interpreting that as kind of a holy glow. And in a way, it does get back to the actual way that we would behold someone, you know, in terms of how light, you know, reflecting off of people or things, you know, light entering our eyes, et cetera.
Well, I think I'm going to get to this in a minute, but I think there could well be something to the idea that beliefs about things like halos or auras could very well be quite literally in the eye of the beholder.
Ah, okay.
So I came across a study that asks an interesting question. Again, you remember I was trying to think, okay, so if people do sometimes look at other people or at figures or even statues of gods or something and believe they see an emanation of light around them, believe they see a nimbus or a holy glow, could people's perceptions of these auras or halos sometimes be explained by cases of synesthesia? This was explored in a paper I was looking at that was published in Consciousness and Cognition in the year 2012 by Milan et al. Called Auras in Mysticism and Synesthesia, a Comparison. So the authors here write that synesthesia, quote, is a condition in which one type of stimulation evokes the sensation of another, as when hearing a sound leads to the perception of mental colors or photisms. Photisms, that's a standard term in the synesthesia literature. It's a type of visual stimulation that associates something that is not originally visual in nature, or is a different kind of stimulus. So one common example in synesthesia is grapheme color synesthesia, where certain letters of the alphabet or numerals are consistently associated with a color sensation. So imagine if you don't experience synesthesia personally, try to imagine if for some reason in your mind the letter G was purple and the letter H was yellow.
Okay.
And there are a bunch of different kinds of this. There are people for whom – I remember reading that one classic attribution of synesthesia was that there was an account of a man, I think maybe reported by John Locke, who said that every time he heard the sound of a trumpet or a French horn or something, he saw the color red.
Mm-hmm.
But there are also some less common types of synesthesia that have specifically to do with the idea or image of individual people. So the authors here write, quote, "One of the relatively infrequent varieties is the one where photisms are triggered by emotion affect-laden stimuli such as emotional words, photographs, human figures, and the faces of familiar people. For instance, for R, a synesthete who participated in this study, the sight of a familiar person automatically triggers a mental image of a human silhouette filled with color. Different people are typically associated with different color hues, depending on R's affective relationship with the person in question, e.g., he claims that he has always associated his mother with the color blue." And I looked this up and I found people online in forums, sure enough, talking about this exact experience today. Like I recall just one example I came across, one person saying that with their person color synesthesia, both of their parents were blue, but different shades of blue. But so anyway, the authors here wanted to tie this to the mystical concept of aura reading or aura perception and ask, is it possible that the neurological phenomenon of person color synesthesia could be responsible for some of the claims of aura vision in these New Age religious experiences? And they tried to figure this out by comparing the first-person reports of four test subjects with person color synesthesia against the performance of aura readers and the reports of auras from the literature. Now, long story short, the authors here actually conclude that these phenomena are described in usually very different ways with different characteristics, and that experiences of person color synesthesia are probably not a major cause of belief in auras. And they put up a table in their conclusion comparing a lot of the differences between these things. Just to mention what I thought were a couple of the most relevant takeaways, and this one seemed maybe the most significant to me. They say that people with person color synesthesia usually report seeing the photism, quote, "in the mind's eye." So there would be like a strong mental association between a person and a color, but most synesthetes do not believe that they are literally seeing the color radiating from the person's body directly in and mingled with their actual vision. It's a mental association.
Okay.
Whereas the aura that the clairvoyant reports is usually said to be a direct visual stimulus, like it's a literal cloud or halo around the body that can be directly observed as you observe things with your eyes. Now, again, there's a lot of variation in this tradition, so I'm sure there are some counterexamples to that, but that seems to be the dominant way that it's reported. A couple of other things they report. Synesthesia is usually a lifelong condition, which is probably congenital, whereas the reported clairvoyant ability to perceive auras is said to be a learned skill more often. They also say that person color synesthesia is triggered automatically and requires no effort. It's just a natural association, as naturally triggered as if I said, what's the color of a banana? Like, you can't help but think it. It just comes automatically to your brain upon hearing the words. They say, counter to that, aura reading usually is said to be something that requires concentration and special conditions.
Now, it does make me wonder obviously you would not have to be a synesthetic person to engage in aura reading. You could easily take on the trappings and the dramatic aspects of this kind of performance. But if you were a person with synesthesia, you would be uniquely outfitted to do this kind of work,
Sure.
To not just say, oh, yeah, you're blue, you're light blue, et cetera. You know to pause and to concentrate and to put on the show that people need to see. Mm-hmm. But then you would have an actual color to refer to, right?
Oh, because you'd have an automatic association in your mind that sort of comes naturally there. Like, you wouldn't have to be straining for something.
Right. But I guess then you're probably getting into a question, okay, in the field of aura reading, are there certain color, I'm sure there are certain colors associated with different things. There's probably a system. There's a color code.
Yeah.
And that color code might not match up with the way that the synesthetic brain is coding the world.
Right, exactly. That's another major difference is that, and they talk about this in the paper, for people with person color synesthesia, they generally understand their individual pairings of certain colors with certain people to be idiopathic, to come from their own personal associations. Whereas usually people who believe that they can read auras say that they're like they're referring to some kind of like objectively external thing that other aura readers would supposedly see the same thing, and it would have a specific meaning.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You want to feel like you're tapping into some sort of cosmic overarching order when you have your aura read, as opposed to just like what this guy thinks in his head when he remembers you.
Sure. But one thing I did want to say, so a couple of things. First of all, I did think it was worth noting, before relying too heavily on the study I just mentioned, I did find a pretty scathing criticism published in the same journal, in Consciousness and Cognition, the same year by Cardania et al., that basically, like, while lauding the general thrust of this study, it also criticized the authors for allegedly being sloppy with a couple of things about, like, how they presented parapsychology in the aura literature. I don't know that this would necessarily change the main findings, but there was some criticism there. So if you're looking into this, look up the critical review as well. But also, I wanted to hand over my Nothing to See Here award to the authors on this one, because it's always nice to see a full write-up of a hypothesis that does not pan out.
Yeah.
But the authors in their conclusion do refer to something else that I thought was interesting. They say, okay, it doesn't look like there's all that strong of a link between the phenomenology of synesthesia and the phenomenology reported by people who do aura readings. It looks like they're reporting different kinds of experiences, so there's probably not a strong causal link. But they also say, quote, claims made by people claiming to be psychic or aura readers can be alternatively explained by proven science. And they refer to a paper by Durden from 2004, which they say, quote, shows how phenomena which arise as a consequence of the normal functioning of the human visual system can explain the purported direct experience of the aura. For instance, the complementary color effect, which results from a temporary exhaustion of the color-sensitive cells in the retina, could account for the presence of auric colors seen by a sensitive viewer when staring at a person. And they also say, staring at a darker object, a human figure, against a bright background may induce the perception of a bright halo around the object. This is due to a contrast amplification mechanism built into the human visual system, which allows for an efficient detection of edges. And so I thought this was interesting that, okay, maybe this would apply even more directly to the halo or the nimbus than it would to the aura perception, because you can imagine a certain number of optical effects, one of which, of course, is the after image. You know, so if you – do you ever do that thing when you're a kid where, like, you look at a picture, a certain sort of, like, negative image of a face on a page, and then they say, okay, stare at this for 20 seconds and then close your eyes and turn your head up, and you'll, like, see a face staring at you from behind your eyelids? That's a natural optical effect, the after image effect that has to do with the latent activation of retinal cells when you've been concentrating on an image. I think it's quite easy to see how something like that could create optical effects that seem quite mystical in nature and could allow you to believe you're perceiving either an aura of color in the shape of a person or surrounding a person, or imagining that you're seeing light emanating from a person.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are a whole host of optical effects like that. Oftentimes, you'll see them utilized at a hands-on science center where you'll have a number of them you can do, where it's like stare at this spinning thing and then look over here, or you know, look at these lines and then look at these lines, and it's all really quite interesting. I mean, so sometimes it's something you do when you're a kid, maybe you forget how interesting it can be, but you know, it goes to show just how our visual system, how it can be tricked into seeing things that are not quite there or enhanced to degrees that don't seem to line up with our normal day-to-day sensory world.
One of my favorite things actually about our visual systems is that, like, you can prove to people through direct experience that their visual perception of reality is an illusion. Now, it's not an illusion as in it's like a totally imagined hallucination. It's obviously based on real objects and light coming in around you. But the perception that you see an unbroken visual field of full color all around you, it really feels like you might see that, but you don't. And a couple of great examples for that you can show people are if you hold up like colored flags at the very periphery of somebody's vision, you can immediately, people immediately realize like, oh, I think I perceive color in every direction, but I'm colorblind in my peripheral vision. That's like, try it sometime if you never have before. Get like different colored markers or flags or something. Hold them up at the very edge of where you can see. You can't tell the difference in the colors. Another one is if you ever want to look up how to do this, there's a way where you can find the blind spot caused by your optic nerve as it routes information away from the retina in the back of your eye. There is a blind spot just right in the middle of your vision, wherever you're looking, the stuff where you can't see anything, and you can actually do experiments to bring this out, but it's totally invisible to you. You can't see the fact that you can't see this area. I think we talked about something like this one time with R. Scott Baker about the fact that he had like an injury to his eye or something that caused to have an illusion of this kind, where in fact he had a large blind spot in the center of his vision, but it didn't register as a blind spot, as in what you might imagine, like a field of black or white or something where there was no vision. Instead, the brain just tricked him into thinking he had total vision, but there were just places where he actually couldn't see anything.
Right, so he would look at his dog, and the dog would just have no face.
Right.
As I recall.
But still the brain's saying, like, no, you're seeing fine. Yeah, this is everything.
It's just a faceless dog. Yeah. Everything's fine.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting Mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get Mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for Mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for Mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots. the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, I want to go from here to talk about halos as a purely optical phenomenon. So these are examples of halos that not only are visible to the naked eye, but they can be captured via photography, and frequently are. Mm-hmm. You know, as mentioned in the previous episode, there are at least a couple of solar and lunar optical phenomena, you know, broad categories of them that are worth singling out. And these phenomena have been observed for thousands of years.
Yeah, this is a really good point. We sort of alluded to this in the last episode, but I just want to emphasize again that I wouldn't suggest that a person needed to have a direct vision of light emanating from another person's body at some point in order to imagine something like a halo or nimbus. It could be just pure imagination that brings out this imagery, or it could well be basic associative thinking, mapping the properties of celestial objects or interesting optical phenomena in the skies or on the earth, and then associating that with a person, you know, with godhood or transcending power, and then putting that on the body of somebody who is feared or revered.
Right. And in the previous episode, we mentioned some Roman and Greek examples of these being observed and recorded. But I do want to drive home that, you know, the sun has always been of importance to cultures throughout time and around the world. So anyone looking up at the sun or the moon were likely to encounter these things. We just have, you know, certain recorded records that are that stand out, that are a little older. I was looking around and I found a paper titled "The Sun Recorded Throughout History" by M. Vasquez from 2009, and they point to bone inscriptions from the Shang Dynasty in ancient China, where they recorded solar phenomena during the second millennium BCE. They reported at least four phenomena, including a dark and gloomy sun, solar eclipses, and the solar halo, which I believe was a Ryun. Interestingly enough, there's another one that there's no translation of. So it does make me wonder what that particular solar phenomenon might have been.
Oh, boy. I bet people have a lot of fun with that one.
Yeah.
That's when the sun turns inside out and becomes the black hole sun.
I mean, I'm sure it's just another, you know, commonly seen occurrence with the sun. But anyway, broadly speaking, a halo can occur anytime the sun or the moon shines through thin clouds composed of ice crystals. And the effect can be caused by one of two or a combination of refraction and or reflection via these crystals. So the refractions are going to cause color separations, meaning the final results may be colored, while reflected light remains uncolored. The 22-degree halo is the most common form of this, consisting of either a series of colored arcs or even complete circles of 22-degree angular radiuses around the sun or the moon. And the coloration, if there's coloration, it tends to be red on the inside and a blur on the outside. With the moon, these are sometimes called lunar halos or winter halos. And I was lucky enough to see one of these the last time I was at the beach. I was out walking on a beach at night and, you know, looking up at the moon, and everything was, you know, beautiful but normal. And then all of a sudden, there's this tremendous halo effect, which if you don't know what you're looking at, it can look like a portal has opened up, like a great circular portal has opened up around the moon, between you and the moon. Like there's some sort of a, you know, a connection or a cylindrical highway between you and the lunar surface. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it makes me think about images in the Paradiso of like rings or wheels of angels running about or in concentric circles around the heavenly bodies.
Yeah, and I you know, again, people throughout time would have witnessed these, and so you can imagine this having an impact on our perception of, you know, the worlds beyond and of the higher cosmos. Now, these are just the most common halo effects, these 22 degrees, but there are many others, including the 46-degree halo. It's similar, but at twice the distance, roughly, sometimes occurring in conjunction with 22-degree halos and even other optical effects. So you might encounter, say, a sun dog with a double halo.
Now, what are sun dogs? That's a different optical phenomenon caused by the sunlight.
Yeah, a sun dog, also known as a mock sun, this is caused by refraction of sunlight in atmospheric ice crystals. These are generally colored patches of light to either side of the sun at the same altitude as the sun itself. So to a certain extent, it can look like three suns dawning over the Earth, or at least like one major sun and like two sort of weirdly shaped mini suns out on either side.
The sun's two suns.
Yeah. And of course, this instantly brings to mind the Chinese myth of the 10 surplus suns that Ho Yi had to shoot down out of the sky. And I've not actually seen a connection. I couldn't find a connection drawn between those two, though it wouldn't surprise me if there was. But there does seem to be a connection in Norse mythology, the two wolves hunting the sun and the moon. So these would be Fenrir's son Skoll and Heiti Horvintensen. I'm not sure if I got that second one, wolf's name right. So cosmic wolves, go easy on me. But there's obviously an eclipse connection as well here, because these are supposed to be like sun and moon consumers. But I did run across direct connections between the sun dogs that are sometimes seen to either side of the sun and these supernatural beasts.
Well, coming back to the version of the halo that is either a ring around the head or an emanation of light as if from behind the head. I mean, obviously, if you have never witnessed a solar eclipse before and seen the corona of the sun around the moon, I mean, that is a probably the most awe-inspiring physical real thing I've ever witnessed. Like it is a life-changing thing to see with your eyes. And but be very careful of your eyes when observing one.
Oh, yeah. And that we'll come back to that in a second. So there are a whole host of rare optical effects related to these examples I've shared that produce various halos. And these have, again, been observed throughout time and depicted in art. Two of the earlier Western examples of their recording are often cited Aristotle's writings on them, as well as the 1535 sundog painting, often held up as the oldest example of a clear atmospheric halo in art. To quote Aristotle, though, in Meteorology from 350 BCE, this is the Webster translation, quote, "The halo often appears as a complete circle. It is seen round the sun and the moon and bright stars by night as well as by day, and at midday or even in the afternoon, more rarely about sunrise or sunset."
Now, it's obvious that seeing things like this in the sky can be awe-inspiring, but is there a reason to suspect connections naturally in history between seeing things like this and religious concepts?
Yeah, absolutely. It seems to be the case. And I think one of the best examples of this is to look at the miracle of the sun, or the miracle of Fatima, on October 13th, 1917 in Fatima, Portugal. A number of you have probably run across this before. You've read an article about it. It involved a variety of reports of colored lights in the daytime sky, of a dancing sun that seemed to move around in the sky, and even angelic apparitions. And there are various interpretations of this, none of which are, you know, can be held up as the definitive answer. Some have pointed to the possibility of mass hallucination or mass hysteria. You know, you would have been dealing with a pretty religious bunch observing this, and in some cases, you're dealing with the observations and recollections of children. But it does sound increasingly likely that it's more a matter of there having been, first of all, a variety of alleged reports, you know, different mm-hmm. stories, people seeing different things in the sky, and some seeing nothing at all out of the ordinary. So it's not like everybody looked up and saw something interesting. Some people looked up and didn't see what anybody was talking about, but it's the most outrageous, the most extreme accounts. They're the ones that survive and then evolve in retellings and in recordings. So again, skeptics have offered a host of possible explanations for this particular incident, but it has been proposed that the whole thing might have started with some manner of a halo or sundog sighting, or some sort of unique combination of these, you know, like sundogs with a couple of halos around the sun. Mm-hmm. And then here's the thing, as various folks start staring at the sun in awe of these phenomena, or trying to see what the person next to them is looking at, they end up staring at the sun too long, and they experience temporary retinal distortion due to prolonged solar staring.
Don't stare at the sun, folks.
Yeah, I mean, remember when we had that solar eclipse in the last few years? You know, that was everybody had to drive that home. Like, even though the sun is doing something really interesting, or is even darkening, do not stare at it because you can seriously damage your eyes. And in the short term, yeah, you could experience temporary retinal distortion, which could have just add to these interpretations of like crazy things going on in the sky.
Well, if you pair this with what I was saying earlier about the possible, like the known effects of vision and optical effects within the eye and within the brain mm-hmm. that are caused by, say, staring for a long time at a bright light source, like you could get effects that wouldn't even necessarily have to be something in the sky, but would also not just be people using their imaginations. They'd be real perceptions for the people, but they could be based on things like retinal effects, after image things, or over perceiving the edges of outlines due to intense strain on the eyes.
Yeah. And then once something like this is observed and thought about, and then once you've had a chance to ask other people about it, then you can often turn to pre-existing scripts to explain what that might have been, mm-hmm. such as angelic beings, such as aliens in unidentified flying objects, that sort of thing.
I just thought of a really great opening for a movie, okay? So it's Fatima, Portugal. Everybody's staring at the sun. They think they see angelic beings or a vision of the Virgin Mary or something like that, apparitions in the sky. And then it slowly resolves, and it's coming in, and what is it? And it's the Predator's dropship. And this is Predator, Portugal. And so all of the Yautja hop out, and they begin their hunt. Is that in bad taste enough to be a Predator movie?
Maybe. I just don't know that they'd get a lot of good sport. Like, you know, they're drawn to the really rough parts of the world, right?
Oh, I guess there's not enough conflict here. There's got to be like a war going on or something.
Yeah, like futuristic LA in, what, 97? Was that when it was supposed to take place?
Oh, yeah, Predator the Danny 2? Glover one, yeah.
Yeah. What if they arrived, the Predators were to arrive, and they're like, okay, we have detected there's a lot of conflict right now. And then they get to their location, and then they find out all the conflict is online. like in social media streams, and they're like, ah, we brought all these weapons, and now we just have to get we have to get Twitter accounts instead and learn English.
Oh, no. So they show up because they're like, okay, the heat signatures we've detected on this place in the surface of the Earth indicate ongoing thermonuclear warfare, but then when they arrive, it's just a Bitcoin mining facility.
Ah. They're like, well, we got to go all in on Bitcoin now, I guess.
We've
traveled all the way here. But then they get to launch the new Predator cryptocurrency, right? Assuming there's not already one.
I'm sure there's already one. There's already like a Garfield cryptocurrency, isn't there?
I don't know, but I would not be surprised. That. No, there could be. I wouldn't put money against you.
OD coin.
Well, I guess we'll close this one out right here. But you know, we're going to keep going with this this line of thinking, though. This idea of optical effects that then get interpreted in various ways. Unless plans change, I think the next episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind will continue on a similar topic.
Yeah, I'm very excited about that. We're going to be sort of moving on from halos mostly. I don't know. It might come back up. But it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah. All right. Well, in the meantime, if you want to catch up on episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you know where to find them. They're in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind feed. These are our core episodes, you know, mostly science and culture and so forth. They publish on Tuesdays and Thursdays. On Wednesdays, we throw out our short form artifact episodes. On Mondays, you got your listener mail. And on Friday, we leave the most of the science up on the shelf, and we take a little time to discuss a weird movie with our Weird House Cinema episodes. So, again, wherever you get your podcast, wherever you find that podcast stream, just rate, review, and subscribe, you know, if you have the ability to do those things. That helps us out.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.